And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. With the novel coronavirus still spreading here and across the nation, new questions arise about whether someone who contracted COVID-19 is vulnerable to reinfection. Some patients have reported a resurgence of the virus after they have originally recovered. Joining Cincinnati Edition to discuss what is known and what doctors are still learning about COVID-19 infection and immunity is University of Cincinnati Health Associate Chairman of Medicine for Translational Research and Professor of Clinical Medicine, Dr. Carl Fichtenbaum. Dr. Fichtenbaum, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me on, Michael. I appreciate it.
It's our pleasure to have you on again. 513-419-7100 is the number to call if you've got questions for Dr. Fichtenbaum as well. And Doctor, I want to start by referencing this article from the New York Times just a couple weeks ago, exploring the question of whether someone can get COVID-19 again. It reports that experts say it's very unlikely. You're an expert. We're going to get you to weigh in just a moment. But here's a little snippet from that article. Quote, these recent accounts tap into people's deepest anxieties that they are destined to succumb to COVID-19 over and over, feeling progressively sicker and will never emerge from this nightmarish pandemic. And these stories fuel fears that we won't be able to reach herd immunity, quote, the ultimate destination where the virus can no longer find enough victims to pose a deadly threat. Dr. Fichtenbaum, is that a legitimate concern?
Well, of course, people always have legitimate concerns, but I think that it's really too soon for us to know. I don't think there are really good, clear, documented cases of people who've been infected once, fully recovered, developed immunity, and then were reinfected again. Now, it's quite possible with coronaviruses that we have circulating in our community now that are just simple common cold viruses, that eventually this particular virus, the SARS-CoV-2, will turn into one of those kinds of recurring common cold viruses. We may not develop fully protective immunity, but we may develop partial immunity where people don't get quite as sick. Alternatively, we may develop a vaccine that people have to take, much like the flu vaccine, to protect themselves from getting influenza every year. So it's really too soon to say. There's a lot of worry and concern. And I think that one of the problems of our society with the rapid dissemination of information is we often get very short snips of information that are not really well-founded scientifically. In the interest of getting news out right away, we get all this information out, and we don't always have the right information, and that can sometimes cause a little bit of concern and panic when it comes out. But, you know, it's not, it takes time for us to really get the right study to understand this question.
And we're talking with Dr. Carl Fichtenbaum. He is a University of Cincinnati Health Associate Chairman of Medicine for Translational Research, also Professor of Clinical Medicine. And Dr. Fichtenbaum, I want to know more about herd immunity as it relates to this conversation about whether people can possibly be infected with COVID-19 again, because we do hear the term herd immunity thrown out about, that this is one of the components of getting beyond this current pandemic. Would you mind just offering us a basic definition of what it means to achieve herd immunity with a virus?
Yeah, so basically what we're looking for is whenever you have a population, say Cincinnati, and if we found that maybe 60 or 70% of Cincinnatians had acquired an infection and they developed some immunity, that the presence of that kind of level of immunity protects the rest of the 30 to 40% of people who are not immune. Because in order for a disease to pass from one person to another, you have to have somebody who's at risk for that infection. And if the virus or whatever is passing bumps up against somebody who has immunity, then what you find is it's a dead end and it can't be passed to the next person. So you don't need to have 100% of everybody protected in order for a community to really be protected. what you have to have is pretty widespread immunity, and somewhere in the neighborhood of that 60 to 70%, when you get to that range, virus diseases don't spread as easily, and we're able to protect each other much better.
Does a vaccine play a role in achieving herd immunity?
Oh, absolutely. So one of the best ways to achieve herd immunity and quickly is to vaccinate a large segment of the population. It's the main reason why we don't see polio circulating. We rarely see measles or mumps. We don't see German measles circulating. And we've had declines in many other diseases as well. Because we vaccinate people, we don't see the terrible sickness that was caused by many of these diseases. So that's a really important concept.
And again, we're talking with Dr. Carl Fichtenbaum, UC Health, Associate Chairman of Medicine for Translational Research, also Professor of Clinical Medicine here in Cincinnati. Can you tell us a little bit about what we're learning about what we gain from those who have been infected, the parts of the virus that have been inside of them that can be taken out and then studied and also possibly used to boost immunity, maybe?
Yeah, so I think it's really, really important that we spend some significant time thinking about people who are being affected by this. It's terrible that they are, and I really feel badly when any human being is harmed. But the best thing that we can do to make of this situation is for us to try and learn, how do people get infected? What does it do to their body when they are infected? Why do some people recover and why do others not recover? How does this virus tick? What makes it work? And what can we do to prevent people from getting infected? And then when they do, how do we treat them the best way? So there's a lot for us to learn. And I think by working together, the community, scientists, and the public, I think we can overcome this. You know, we're pretty creative little creatures. We've been around for thousands and thousands of years, and we seem to have overcome many obstacles. So I'm pretty confident we'll be able to overcome this one, although it seems pretty terrible to many of us right now, and it's certainly impairing our ability to function as we normally know how to do in society.
As we see the case numbers rise around the country, and many people are starting to become possibly impatient with the response from the federal government during this pandemic, what are you all learning as researchers in this field as you look at the way other countries have handled this situation? New Zealand was in the news over the weekend pretty heavily because they hadn't had a single case of COVID-19 in that country in 100 days. And you look at countries like America, Brazil, Russia, and also the interesting case of Sweden, which never really fully locked down and apparently was moving towards herd immunity anyway. What are you researcher types learning during this pandemic when you review the ways different governments have responded?
Well, I think we have to all remember that science, the community, politics, economics, it is all interwoven together. And I can't do research and try to discover what's going on with some disease without having some connection to the greater parts of society that make things run. And I think what we understand is that protecting the public health is a social contract with all of us. And it requires all of us to be willing to get onto the same page for the greater good and protection of society. I think that one of the tenets of our country has been this rugged individualism, which has led to many interesting and great discoveries. But at the same time, it's a double-edged sword. If you don't want to listen to your neighbors and you're unwilling to compromise, then you have to be willing to suffer the consequences of inaction or wrong actions. And I think we see some countries that do a better job of bringing everything together in the name of their public health. And other countries like ours, where we are struggling a little bit, where there is a constant assault on what is truth. And I think we're seeing these consequences. And so I hope that we can use these moments to learn how can we do it better. And rather than putting blame, figure out solutions to move forward, because we need a more organized, more coordinated, more unified response from all of our communities and our entire country so that we can lessen the effects. We are making our way up to more than 200,000 people that will succumb from this disease. And it doesn't have to be that way if we all do our part.
And you're listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks, and joined today by Dr. Carl Fichtenbaum. He is UC Health Associate Chairman of Medicine for Translational Research, also a professor of clinical medicine. 513-419-7100 is the number to call if you've got a question for Dr. Fichtenbaum. Doctor, we mentioned moments ago that herd immunity is boosted when there's a vaccine available, and the National Institutes of Health collaborating with Moderna on a coronavirus vaccine. I believe you're involved in a Moderna trial at the University of Cincinnati. Is that right?
Yes, I am.
Well, tell us a little bit about what the status is of that work.
Yeah, well, so the government, the federal government and the National Institute of Health have developed some very important partnerships with various companies, and we are working on more than just the Moderna vaccine, but a number of other companies, so that there are going to be at least five vaccine studies that are a partnership between government and business. And Moderna is one of them, and it's the first vaccine study. It's currently enrolling nationally. Ultimately, there will be 89 sites available. We are one of those sites, and we expect to begin our enrollment in the next 2 weeks here locally in Cincinnati. And these are very important studies because I think, like many things, we sometimes have to try a few different approaches before we find the right solution. And we will need more than just one vaccine. It's quite possible there may be a couple of vaccines that work. And if they work to prevent disease and prevent severe disease, then that'll be a very important ray of hope and a way for us to create some positive future for our country. So we're very excited at the University of Cincinnati and UC Health to be able to offer this to Cincinnatians. And, you know, if people want to sign up for the study, then they certainly can contact us. We have a number of ways in which people can reach us. One way is through email. If you type in UC COVID research at uchealth.com, you can send us an email and we will certainly get you signed up. And we also have a phone number as well that people can call, so that if you don't have access to a computer or something like that, then we can, you know, certainly have you call 513-245-3417. And you can also call there to say you are interested in the study. We are certainly looking to engage a lot of people within our community. We're also partnering with Children's Hospital, which is doing some of the vaccine studies at the Gamble Institute, and they do a terrific job and have a great program. So we hope to make sure that Cincinnati is part of the cutting edge of research and the ability to solve this terrible pandemic.
And that's Dr. Carl Fichtenbaum from UC Health. And doctor, in the few minutes that we have left, I would be remiss if I didn't ask, you know, there are a lot of people, a lot of different entities and organizations working on vaccines around the world. And it's often suggested that we're not going to be back to what we used to know as normal until we have this thing. Any idea on the timeline on how this will work on gathering the information and ultimately leading to production of a vaccine?
Well, as I always tell people, my crystal ball works very well, but it's in my closet and it has a crack in it. And I haven't been able to discern things. I'm very good at predicting the past, but predicting the future is always tricky. My guess would be, my hope would certainly be by the end of this year in January, we may have a little clue, a preliminary clue about some of the early vaccine studies and whether or not they're showing a signal of some positive effect. And that once we see an initial signal, we have to figure out, is it strong enough that we can be certain that we know the vaccine is working and of great importance that the vaccine is safe. So those are the two primary things for us to really find out. Is it safe? And is it showing a signal of working? And if it is, then I think in 2021, we will be able to begin producing lots of vaccine and make it available for the public and distribute it. Remembering, of course, that, you know, supply chain issues and manufacturing always takes time. And it's not as if we found an answer in January or February that everybody could line up at their local pharmacy on March 1st and get a vaccine. It takes a little bit of time to get these things distributed. But I'm optimistic and hopeful that in 2021, we will have some answers and that we'll begin to be able to vaccinate the public in a broader way so that we can really bring some closure to this and get back to the business of normal societal life.
And Dr. Fichtenbaum, in talking a little bit about America's struggle in responding to the COVID-19 pandemic, you referenced some skepticism among certain parts of the general public and some distrust, some concerns over what is truth in our nation. Governor Mike DeWine tested positive for COVID-19 in one of those rapid tests just before he was to meet with President Trump and then was later tested again and found to be negative. That seems to play into the confusion and the skepticism about whether the disease is real and something to be feared. I'm wondering if you could help us understand what happened with those two types of tests.
Yeah, so it's very important to understand whenever we are trying to develop new testing that it takes time and a significant amount of trial and error to tune up a test correctly. If you think about this, just think about trying to learn something new, like riding a bicycle. There are very few people that jump on a bicycle the very first time and don't ever fall over. It takes a little bit of trial and effort. The same is true for developing tests. And antigen tests for viruses are notoriously known to have some problems and take time to get tuned up correctly. Some of them can be falsely negative, and we see this very commonly, for example, with influenza testing. And then also, some of them can be falsely positive when there are interfering substances that will turn the test positive, but in fact is not the virus we're really concerned about. So the best test we have is the actual genetic test, testing for the virus itself. And that takes a little bit more time. It's not something you can just swab someone's nose and then, you know, 10 minutes later, you have an answer. I think people want answers that are quick so you can decide. But I think like anything else, it takes time for us to get the test tuned in the right way. We have to sometimes add a little bit of this, change a little bit of that. And that's why it's confusing sometimes, because he was a victim of a false positive test. He didn't have the disease. He has had two negative genetic tests for the virus SARS-CoV-2. And so I understand why people can be confused. But it's like anything, you know, that human beings do. There are some false negatives and false positives.
Dr. Carl Fichtenbaum is UC Health Associate Chairman of Medicine for Translational Research, also Professor of Clinical Medicine. Dr. Fichtenbaum, we always enjoy having you on. Thanks for sharing some more expertise with us today, and we'll look forward to talking to you again, maybe with an update on the vaccine situation.
Sure. Always happen. I will. Happy to be helpful. Yeah, anytime.
All right. Thank you so much for being with us today.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer of today's show is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Our theme music is composed by Rob Fetters. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monk.